Welcome back to CMDA Matters, a weekly podcast of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, where we focus on changing hearts in healthcare. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Chupp, and today we will be featuring the second half of an interview with Dr. Leonard Sachs on how the transgender movement is harming vulnerable children. If you missed last week, be sure to go back and listen to part one. Dr. Sachs is not only a medical doctor, but also has a PhD in psychology, as he's a board-certified family physician since 1990. And over the last 20 years, he's visited over 400 schools and parent groups to discuss matters of gender and sexuality in children and adolescents. He's published four books, including Boys Adrift, Girls on the Edge, and The Collapse of Parenting, which became a New York Times bestseller. Dr. Jeff Barrows and I recently reviewed his updated book, Why Gender Matters. We were also troubled when we read his public discourse essay on why the American Academy of Pediatrics has actually damaged the trust of pediatricians, other healthcare professionals, and the public at large by advancing treatment guidelines for kids with gender dysphoria that are not at all based on solid or convincing evidence. I invite you now to listen in on part two of Dr. Sachs on why gender matters more than ever. Dr. Sachs, I just wanted to ask, as we look to the future, and you know, our listeners are healthcare professionals, mostly physicians and those in training to become physicians. What is the way forward for us to take back the narrative on this particular issue? And, you know, I've been told that maybe a better phrase to use in this whole idea of counseling these children and parents is change allowing therapy, not conversion therapy, because those on the other side who have a different viewpoint than we do just immediately relate conversion therapy to archaic things that no licensed professional would ever do anymore, electrical shock therapy and some forms of sexual abuse that are just absolutely no one would support today. But how can we get back on track, whether it's helping to change the narrative or it's to point our fellow professionals, whether or not they are coming from a basis of any faith background? I'm told that even many scientists who are atheists and agnostic are very concerned about where medical science is today, the Hippocratic way, the way of medicine, basing our management interventions upon evidence-based science. And in your editorial in the public discourse, you wrote that one article is cited from 1994 dealing with reparative therapy, one article about adults change or conversion therapy or whatever they want to call it for sexual orientation of homosexual men and women. And of course, that's so different from a child, from a five-year-old, seven-year-old, or adolescent. How can we be a part of fixing this problem of ignoring good evidence or the flip side, bad or lack of evidence?
Well, again, to clarify for listeners, the American Academy of Pediatrics considered the question, is it appropriate for doctors and professionals confronting that seven-year-old boy who says he's a girl, is it appropriate for them to engage in watchful waiting and wait a few years and see if this persists? And they denounced that. They said, no, watchful waiting is equivalent to conversion therapy, and we know conversion therapy is harmful. And in support of that statement, as you pointed out, they cited one study, a study from 1994, which documented the failure of efforts to try to get gay men to be straight men. Well, a 25-year-old study of efforts to get gay men to be straight men is really not relevant to the question of how to work with a seven-year-old boy who says he's a girl. They are confusing sexual orientation with gender identity, which are profoundly different issues. They're confusing prepubescent children with adults, which is a really surprising error for a group of pediatricians to make. Pediatricians presumably understand that seven-year-olds are not adults, and studies on adults are of doubtful relevance to seven-year-olds. So what are we to do? Well, we have to continue pointing to the evidence. And look, there are some people out there on both sides, left and right, who are not open to reason and not interested in argument. There are people on the far right who believe that America is run by Satanist pedophiles. There are people on the far left who believe that gender is just a matter of performance, that it has no reality. Maybe I shouldn't say far left, because it brings to mind Judith Butler, professor at Berkeley, who's won every award that an academic can win, basically. And that is her belief, that gender is nothing but a performance, that it has no foundation in biological fact. Well, you're not going to persuade anyone at the extremes. But people who are open to argument, who are open to listening to what the evidence actually shows, those are the people that I'm speaking to. That's the people I wrote my book for. And the great majority of parents that I encounter are looking for evidence-based answers. Maybe that's just because that's my reputation and those are the parents who contact me. But certainly there are many such parents out there, and those are the parents we have to reach. Those are the parents who are most at risk from a toxic environment where they're being told that if you don't immediately transition your kid to the opposite sex, you are abusive. We will begin the process, Child Protective Services, to take custody of your child away from you. Those are the parents who need support and encouragement and connection to professionals who are still doing evidence-based medicine.
One of the problems that we're seeing and looking forward is that many of the studies that really should be done are not going to be performed because of a variety of reasons, being cited as being unethical. But do you agree that many of the studies that are going to be coming out are already going to be biased in the way that they are done and may not really come up with what really good evidence?
Well, indeed. So last year, a much ballyhooed study was published showing that transitioning to the opposite sex had tremendous benefits for individuals who were transgender. And then just really a few weeks ago, we learned, oops, they actually misinterpreted their data. And the data do not at all support the conclusion. In fact, the data that they cited shows no benefit of transition to the opposite sex. The study last year got a tremendous amount of news coverage. The retraction and correction got very little news coverage, although it was prominently mentioned in public discourse, which had an article highlighting the errors in the original study and the retraction. So it is troubling that the scientific community itself has been infiltrated and corrupted. And as a result, parents who just Google this question and read the New York Times are likely to be very misled. And again, that was a motivation for writing an updated edition of my book, Why Gender Matters, to give parents who are looking for an evidence-based approach, to give them that evidence. There are over 400 scholarly citations in the second edition of my book, Why Gender Matters. And I encourage parents to look up those references and read the original sources so that you will be prepared.
Dr. Sachs, I wanted to read to you, if I can, a comment by the dean of the Brown School of Public Health, Bess Marcus, after a much acclaimed study that was retracted, taken out of the journal by Brown, by Lisa Littman. This was in late 2018. And, you know, at first there was some talk by Brown that maybe her methodology was flawed. But the dean didn't want anyone from the LGBT community to be confused that she was looking out after their interests. And so this is what she said. Brown community members expressing concerns that the conclusions of the study could be used to discredit efforts to support transgender youth and invalidate the perspectives of members of the transgender community. So basically, alumni of Brown complained to Brown, and therefore, because of the concerns of their alumni, they said, we might, with this study, invalidate their perspective. Now, I wonder if there's really hope for us. How will we be able to overcome if any sort of hypothesis or postulate might discredit or invalidate the perspective of any group of people? And I just had a guest on the program. We were talking about post-truth. I fear the day when in medicine that we are ignoring evidence and truth because our patients and their children and their children's children will be the ones who will suffer.
I'd like to share a couple of thoughts there. So first of all, not all your listeners may know Lisa Littman's article. Again, Lisa Littman, a gynecologist actually, is doing research at Brown, was interested in this question of why we now see so many teenage girls who, as teenage girls, suddenly decide that they are boys. Now, we have an extensive literature on transgender and gender dysphoric individuals going back really to the 1960s. And for most of that era, from 1960 through 2010, the great majority, certainly more than 70% of individuals who were gender dysphoric were individuals born male who believed that they were female. Many of these individuals, as little boys, wanted to dress up as ballerinas and throughout life are demonstrating this gender dysphoria, that they're not comfortable in the male role. That's been around for a long time. And indeed, right through 2010, gender dysphoric individuals born male, outnumbered individuals born female by at least 3-1 as a rule. 70-80% or more were individuals born male. Then in the mid-2010s, in the last 10 years, something changed. And all of a sudden, there was an explosion of teenage girls who at 14, 15, 16, 17 years of age, suddenly decide that they are boys. And many of these girls were absolutely gender typical as little girls, and the parents will show you pictures of this girl dressing up as a ballerina for Halloween at 8 years of age. And now at 16 years of age, she's insisting that she is a boy. This is quite new. Between 2010 and 2019, the number of girls in the United States who said that teenage girls who said that they're boys increased 40-fold. For every one girl who said that in 2010, there were more than 40 such girls in 2019, an explosion. And we have the same numbers in the United Kingdom, more than a 40-fold increase in less than 10 years. Lisa Littman was asking the question, why is this happening? And she documented by interacting with the families of several hundred of these girls that, first of all, these cluster. If one popular girl decides she's a boy, then suddenly her friends follow her and also say that they're boys, and that this comes on suddenly. And Lisa Littman coined the phrase rapid onset gender dysphoria. So she simply published her findings, the result of her survey information with several hundred of these families, demonstrating that, yes, this is indeed rapid onset. These girls, the great majority of them have no history prior to age 12 or 13 of any gender dysphoria. They were happy being girls. And the majority of these girls also are struggling with significant anxiety, depression, or other psychiatric issues. Simply an empirical study describing her findings, and yet it prompted this hurricane of pushback and prompted this comment from the Brown University dean that you quoted. The second comment I wanted to make, though, I think one lesson from this and from similar stories like it is that the Ivy League has gone off the rails. Now, you and I were raised in an era where we regarded Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown as leading scholarship. that era is over. Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown have demonstrated that they are utterly politicized, mm-hmm. and that ideas at those universities are judged not on their empirical basis, but on whether or not they conform to the ideology that now prevails at those schools. But the good news is that American higher education is much bigger than Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown, the University of Texas, Austin, the University of Wisconsin, Madison. I was discussing this with my best friend from childhood, Keith Gandel, who is a professor of English at the City University of New York. And I said to him, what do you think about, you know, all this political correctness now at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown, UT, Austin, University of Wisconsin, Madison? How does it affect you? He said, it does not affect me at all. He said, all that political nonsense, that's going on at the quote-unquote top-tier universities. The second tier is where real scholarship is done. Hmm. And he said his students have no interest in gender ideology or critical race theory. Incidentally, the majority of his students are students of color. But they couldn't care less about this. They want to learn. They want to study the great works, the masterpieces of English literature. That's why they're in his class. They want to learn math and science and engineering and literature and foreign languages. So a lot of this stuff that we read about in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and everyone getting so excited about Brown punishing this professor because she dared to publish an article suggesting that these girls are just following the popular girl. Well, it's a condemnation of Brown, to be sure. But don't confuse Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown, UT, Austin with what's really happening in American secondary education. America is much bigger than those leading lights. Yes, it's a shame. I grieve that the leading universities have lost their way, but that doesn't mean that the country is completely deranged.
Dr. Sachs, if I could ask you a final question. I'm just interested in your thoughts. Because of your interest over the last 15 to 20 years, what do you think about the whole issue of informed consent and what's going to happen in our country? Are we going to experience in the next 10, 15, 20 years that even if our professional associations and if physicians who care about empirical medicine do not win the day, that eventually the lawyers actually, because of the issue of informed consent, actually may win the day? And I'm just thinking of Tavistock in England and what's happened there, and that the foundations of that prominent gender clinic are crumbling because of a lawsuit and accusations of really a lack of informed consent, medicalization of children, and life, of course, infertility as a result. It's hard for me to think of something worse than stealing someone's fertility. But what do you think about the issue of informed consent?
Well, I think that's one of many ways in which this insanity may be corrected. So, as you know, I'm a family doctor, and I recently saw a new patient who was coming to see me because she was sick. She had a bad upper respiratory infection, a bad bronchitis, not quite a pneumonia. So I needed to prescribe an antibiotic. Well, this individual was born female, but has transitioned to the male role. But she still has all of her female equipment. So she is taking birth control pills to prevent pregnancy, but she is also taking high-dose testosterone to masculinize her appearance. And this individual has facial hair and a deep voice. So if you're going to be a responsible physician, you must check to make sure that your medication will not interact with the medications your patient is taking. So I pulled up UpToDate, which is the app I like to use to check on the latest medical information. And I looked to see how many scholarly articles there are addressing individuals, adolescent or adult, born female, who are taking both birth control pills and high-dose testosterone. All right, how many such scholarly articles are there? There are none. There is no published research. Mm. These kids are being experimented upon. This is a teenager under 18 years of age who is being experimented on. Well, who gave informed consent? And on what basis did they give consent? Was it likely that the prescriber said, look, we have no idea what the long-term consequences are of using high-dose testosterone alongside high-dose estrogen? No one's ever done that. We don't know what that's going to do as far as blood clots, cardiovascular disease. No idea. Are you fine with that? Well, I've talked with some of these kids, and I'll say, has anyone talked with you about the risks of taking these medicines together? Oh, no, they said it'd be fine. Hmm. No, they said this is standard of care. Okay, well, that prescriber has created liability for themselves, for the prescriber, because they, according to the patient and their parents, no one has warned them about the risks. Now, maybe there's a document that they signed somewhere that they didn't read, but in any case, we will find out over the next 10 to 20 years when these kids are unhappy and sue the prescribing physicians. Will be interesting to see. You know, we can talk. I'm not a lawyer, so then the question is, well, what about the statute of limitations? Would that apply? What legal defenses can these doctors use to protect themselves from liability? But yeah, I think if the leaders of the medical profession have lost their way, as is clearly the case with regard to the leadership of the American Academy of Pediatrics, will the lawyers be the ones who ring the curtain down on this craziness? It is possible. I can think of other ways that this will end, but I'm confident it will end. A lie cannot last forever. Mm-hmm. It can last for many years, but it cannot last forever. The truth will eventually triumph.
Well, can I encourage you, Dr. Sachs, because you are an excellent writer, now that I've read your book, Why Gender Matters, to consider this topic for your next book, maybe. I know that your mother had obviously influence on you to go into medicine as a pediatrician. I can think of a biblical Old Testament mother who challenged her son using the name King Lemuel. We believe that probably was Solomon in Proverbs chapter 31. And I'm going to close this interview with this. And just to encourage you to keep speaking out, Dr. Sachs, keep doing what you're doing. At CMDA, we appreciate you speaking out about evidence and about protecting children. But King Lemuel's mother said to him in Proverbs 31, 8 and 9, speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Ensure justice for those being crushed. Yes, speak up for the poor and helpless, and see that they get justice. And I believe that with your knowledge base, I think that you would do us justice by pursuing this with another book, Dr. Sachs.
Well, thank you very much. Well,
I just want to thank you for all your work, Dr. Sachs, in educating parents, especially in Why Gender Matters. It's a big help for parents to understand the importance of gender, and on all of your excellent suggestions and practical measures on how to raise kids. So just keep up the great work.
Thanks again.
I thoroughly enjoyed that two-part conversation with Dr. Sachs. And I know that some of you as listeners are probably thinking, hey, I'm in a specialty that's really not involved with kids or adolescents and those who are struggling and trying to figure out their gender. I just want to remind you that just recently on the campaign presidential election stage, our president-elect, Joe Biden, specifically mentioned about a seven-year-old that he would make sure would never be discriminated against. And I believe what our president-elect was referring to is guidelines from the AAP and how primary care physicians taking care of kids had better be very careful what you recommend to parents and kids who have gender dysphoria. Well, with that in mind, I don't often recommend a single reference in the literature, but I do have one to recommend this week. And that is an article by someone who's not a CMDA member. He's actually working in the Toronto Sexuality Center, Toronto, Canada, entitled Transgender and Gender Diverse Children and Adolescents, Fact Checking of the AAP Policy. I want to tell you, I've read a number of synopsis review articles, but I've never come across one that so very effectively examines every single reference that the AAP used in coming up with their guidelines for the treatment of transgender and gender diverse children. And basically, Dr. Cantor, one by one, shows very clearly how the articles, the references being used, do not at all support the recommendations. Please don't forget that you can find Dr. Sachs's book, Why Gender Matters, on Amazon, including the audiobook version on Audible. This book is packed full of valuable and well-researched information on scientifically documented gender differences between boys and girls, which is becoming more difficult to find in our current post-truth and politically correct culture. If you'd like more information on this complicated issue that is not going to go away anytime soon, I encourage you to browse our online bookstore at CMDA. We have several great resources featured on our webpage that are devoted to the transgender issue, including God and the Transgender Debate by Andrew Walker and When Harry Became Sally by Ryan Anderson. We've made these and many other excellent resources available to help you to be better informed about the gender confusion that our modern age is experiencing. In fact, back in October, Andrew Walker, author of the first book I mentioned, he joined CMDA for a webinar entitled Healthcare Professionals, the Church, and the Transgender Movement. You can actually watch that recorded presentation on YouTube simply by going to cmda.org/transgender, and that video link is at the top of that webpage. I'll mention again, as we approach Christmas, that our CMDA bookstore has a lot of great resources that will make great gifts for your loved ones and friends, especially those who are Christians in healthcare. You can find all of these and more just by going to cmda.org/store or by calling 888-230-2637. Hey, I want to encourage you to be sure to sign up for the CMDA Remedy Conference this January 9th and 10th on Zoom. I, along with three other international speakers, will be speaking on topics that we hope will inspire you to think creatively about how you will use your healthcare expertise to bring the hope and healing of Christ to our world in crisis. The conference will include worship, live TED Talks, live chat with highly qualified speakers in breakout rooms, as well as networking opportunities with healthcare and service organizations. Your registration will also give you access to a Zoom topical meetup after the conference has concluded. You're going to want to make sure that you check out our Remedy Conference, and you can go to cmda.org/remedy to register today. We have a very busy advocacy team at CMDA National Ministry, and they would like you to know we are opposing radical abortion legislation introduced both in Massachusetts and New Jersey. The New Jersey Reproductive Freedom Act, if passed, would explicitly guarantee the right to abortion for the entire 9 months of pregnancy. It would also endanger women seeking abortions by allowing non-physicians, actually, to perform these complicated procedures. Finally, it would actually invalidate the state's current conscience clause, protecting healthcare professionals' right to refuse involvement in abortion procedures. The Roe Act, as it's called in Massachusetts, would publicly fund abortions. It would also permit abortions beyond 24 weeks for almost any reason as determined by a physician, and allow minors to obtain an abortion without parental consent. Both bills are coming up for hearing soon and have a high likelihood, unfortunately, of passing. We plead with you to pray, listeners, that both bills will miraculously be defeated. In our fight against the legalization of marijuana and physician-assisted suicide in various states, our advocacy team created succinct fact sheets on both of those topics to equip our AAME state directors in their advocacy efforts. If you'd also like to receive those, please email us at communications@cmda.org.
www.brownschoolofpublichealth.org. This past week, we sent an email to all of our student and resident members, enabling them to opt in to our public policy emails that we periodically send out. We hope that all interested students and residents will take advantage of this opportunity to be informed and then to serve. We want you to know that the Christian voice matters. As Christians, we can have a godly influence in shaping decisions made on the national and state legislative levels. If you're interested in engaging in public policy in your state or locality, please contact us. Just use the email communications@cmda.org, and one of our advocacy staff will get right back to you. I want to thank you today for listening to part two of my conversation with Dr. Leonard Sachs. I continue to pray that God will raise up more Christian healthcare professionals to get involved in these important discussions at this time. We see all around us the brokenness of our society, with one New York Times religion editor, Ross Douthat, calling this time the age of American despair. The reality is that we live in a fallen world, and separation from God brings about suffering. Christian healthcare professionals like you and me, we provide the answer to this brokenness in the gospel as ministers of reconciliation, being salt and light every day. I imagine many of you chose the healthcare profession because the suffering of people, not only in this country, but around the world, matters to you. It certainly matters to Jehovah Rapha, our healer, and to CMDA, and CMDA matters. Thank you for serving God in this way. We'll see you next week, God willing.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.